Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to be talking about genital herpes. I called mine Where To Next in Public Health Practice, and then I found out that Peter had the same title. So I guess we're all going down the same road. So briefly, what I'm going to do is talk about herpes simplex epidemiology. I'm going to talk a bit about the operating framework for us in New York City at the City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene STD clinics, and some considerations as we think about herpes control in the New York City STD clinics. So let's talk a little bit about the epidemiology. I know that Peter discussed this earlier. Clearly, it's something that in this country is highly prevalent. Most genital herpes infections are currently unrecognized by people who are infected. As far as the prevalence, we're talking mostly about HSV-2, by the way, but increasingly about HSV-1. You had heard earlier about the facilitation of the transmission and acquisition of HIV. And we agree that symptom-driven care is really an incomplete strategy for preventing disease transmission. Is there a laser pointer here? All right. There is a... Okay. These are data from the New York City Health and Nutrition Exam Survey, which the data were collected in 2004. And one of the things that was, this survey is largely based on the methodologically on the national survey, but this was done for and by New York City. And one of the things that was looked at was HSV-2 seropositivity. And you can see here HSV-2 seroprevalence in persons greater than 20 years of age by race ethnicity, shown in the clumps of bars here at the on the x-axis, and by sex, blue being male, pink being female. And I think the thing that's striking here is you have white non-Hispanics, black non-Hispanics, and you have what looks like almost a doubling of the size of the bars. And also really striking is that black non-Hispanic females has HSV-2 seroprevalence of about 61%. Similarly, you see rates higher than among whites among the Hispanic group. But I think the take-home message here is that the rates among women are much higher than the rates among men. This is looking at the percent of HSV-2 seropositive individuals who reported that they had never been diagnosed with a genital herpes infection by sex and race. And the real take-home from this slide is that in New York City, at least, no matter which racial ethnic group, non-Hispanic white, Hispanic, or non-Hispanic black, among women, the vast majority reported that they had never been diagnosed with genital herpes. Also, you see that among some of the groups of men. So, thinking about genital herpes, those were New York City-specific population data, at least one out of four New Yorkers has an HSV-2 infection. There are racial disparities in seroprevalence, again, not unlike what's been seen nationally. Women are almost twice as likely to be infected as men, irrespective of race, and most are unaware of their infection. So let me tell you a little bit about the STD clinic system in New York City. The care that we provide in our clinics is mandated through New York State public health law, which mandates that each health jurisdiction, of which New York City is one, needs to provide free and confidential services for residents infected or suspected of being infected with an STD. The New York State Sanitary Code goes on to spell out what constitutes an STD, and that includes genital herpes simplex, obviously among others. Some of our financial realities are that our clinical services are supported nearly entirely by city tax levy dollars. All of our services, as per state law, are free to the patient. We do bill Medicaid for HIV counseling and testing, as well as for chlamydia gonorrhea testing. And the kicker is that the revenues that are generated from Medicaid billing do not go back to the STD program. They go to the general New York City coffers. So we never see anything that comes back from that. We are available for episodic STD care. Our services are free, as I had mentioned, at our 10 clinics that are located throughout the five boroughs of New York City. Services are available 6 days per week, and we will provide STD care for anyone who is 12 years of age or greater, without parental consent, without proof of citizenship required, and without proof of health insurance required. And what happens at those visits? Well, we routinely screen everyone for chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, and HIV, as we have now moved to opt-out testing rather than opt-in testing. We also offer hepatitis A and B immunization. We offer PAP tests for women, cervical PAP, emergency contraception, targeted risk-based screening for hepatitis C. As far as herpes is concerned, we provide lesion-based testing. We use culture. We do not use PCR. It is not available to us. We provide acyclovir for patients, it should say, with primary acute outbreaks. That is our written policy. In reality, it's a little bit different. And we do not have type-specific serologic testing for HSV available to us at this time. Let me tell you a little bit about our budget. Our budget is about $6 million per year. 85% of that budget goes for personnel. The remaining 15% it amounts to about $900,000, which are spent for everything from supplies to diagnostic testing to treatment. Since 2003, our patient volumes have been increasing by about 7% per year. And I think that much of that increase in volume has been driven by the advent of rapid HIV testing, particularly oral fluid testing, the implementation of the use of emergency contraception in our clinics, and our expanded hours. So last year, 2007, we had about 114,000 visits to our clinics. Those visits represent 78,000 plus unique individuals. Our male to female ratio is 1.3 to 1. That's true for whether we're talking about visits or talking about patients. And similarly, whether we're talking about visits or patients, our population is about 50% black, non-Hispanic, 25% Hispanic, and 20% white. 23% of all of our patients are black, non-Hispanic women, and 10% of all of our patients are men who report sex with other men. Some considerations for a genital herpes control program at the New York City STD clinics, then. We could start out by saying our patients are at high risk for HSV, probably higher than what we see in New York City in general, which are the data I presented earlier. And the New York City data are, although consistent in pattern with national data, there's a higher seroprevalence in New York City than nationally for HSV2. As our major considerations for implementing a genital herpes control program include laboratory screening costs, counseling messages, and clinical management issues. This is our average cost, or our average expenditures on the different tests that are shown here. What you can see is our standard screening packet that I talked about earlier, which includes syphilis, GC chlamydia, and HIV, and this is a genitourinary NATS test, ranges anywhere from $1.91 on average for syphilis testing to $13.82 for HIV rapid testing or HIV testing. And if we look at herpes culture, which is what we currently use, each culture costs us about $10.23. And our HSV type-specific serology, which we, you know, looking at the referral labs that we currently have, there are city contracts with, type-specific serologies cost $16.35. So if we were to do type-specific HSV serologic screening of our STD patients one time in 2007, all of our patients here are represented by the 78,000 I told you about earlier. That would amount to an annual cost of $1.2 million. That is in excess of our entire budget for doing testing, treatment, supplies. If we were just thinking about being selective in the way we screen, it would make good sense to screen black females. We saw very high rates in that group. That would cost us about $295,000 dollars, which is almost $300,000, which is about a third of our entire other than personnel services budget. If we looked at just men who have sex with men, that's about 7,000 in number, and that would cost us about $113,000. We looked at patients who reported at least six lifetime partners, and that would cost about $22,000. And if we looked at the HIV positives who are either diagnosed in our clinic or prevalent positives who come to our clinics for other reasons, that would come to $13,000. As far as counseling is concerned, we still do diagnose HSV in our clinics. And key things that need to be included in counseling or key questions that come up among the folks who do the counseling are explaining to the patient the timing of the initial infection, the lifelong nature of the infection, the shedding patterns in terms of where the shedding happens, when the shedding happens, and if we're talking about HSV-1 versus HSV-2, the messages are slightly different. The concept of asymptomatic shedding. Again, you don't even know where you're shedding from, but we have to explain that this could be happening at any given moment. And, of course, the message around facilitation of HIV acquisition and transmission. Patients also need to learn how to recognize symptoms of an acute outbreak, since so much HSV seems to be unrecognized. We know that not everybody has outbreaks, but there are people who have outbreaks that don't recognize them, so that we can give patients some prevention information about, you know, not having sex during an outbreak, but also in terms of the prevention of transmission of HIV in addition to HSV. Explaining the utility of condoms and their limitations, quite frankly, and to discuss treatment options with the patient. We need to discuss disclosure issues and the risk for and prevention of perinatal transmission. And although I didn't include it here, some of the feedback that I've gotten from staff also has to do with patients thinking that now that they have herpes, they can't ever get pregnant. We also need to think through the development of an institutional HSV treatment policy. Should we be offering a first course of a short course of suppressive therapy for all HSV positives or just symptomatics? Should we be referring for suppressive therapy? Who would we refer to? Who wants patients with herpes who need suppressive therapy? It's much easier for the HIV positive patient, but for another patient, it may not be so easy. Should we be initiating suppressive therapy? Should we be just giving out prescriptions for suppressive therapy? In general, we try to dispense whatever we can. Maybe we need to do some combination of the three. And then, how do we manage those who keep coming back? Our written policy is that we prescribe treatment for folks who are having a primary outbreak of herpes. But the fact is that people, whether it's a primary outbreak or not, keep coming back. We are a provider of last resort. We provide same-day service on a walk-in basis. We have convenient hours, and people do come back. What do we do with those who are coming back with actual symptoms of an outbreak? De facto, right now, we just provide another course of acyclovir. What about those who make multiple STD clinic visits, who are here for other reasons? Should we be offering them an additional course of acyclovir? And then there are those who are going to come seeking suppressive therapy, whether we refer them elsewhere or not. And then there are the formulary decisions, acyclovir versus valacyclovir. These are the average wholesale prices that were given to our pharmacist for acyclovir, the 400 milligram tabs, $172.44 for 100 of them. And valacyclovir, 500 milligrams, the 500 milligram formulation, at about five times that cost. Now, granted, the dosing regimens are different between the two, but depending on which regimen you are considering, we need to work through those numbers. And again, the question of dispensing versus prescribing versus referring or some combination. Other considerations in the backdrop that we cannot forget is that our patient volumes are increasing. Our STD, some of you may have heard this morning about the fact that we have gone to express visits because we just couldn't handle the patient volume that is coming to us. Our STD clinic budget is finite and diminishing, and that's probably not different from other places. And a self-sustaining revenue stream for services just isn't permissible at this time. So what are we left with? Well, you know, another consideration is that universal screening for us, as given the data that I showed earlier, is just simply unaffordable. Selective screening is more affordable, but it raises important equity issues. And although it is true that there is selective screening recommended for chlamydia, in our clinics we do universal screening because our yields are so high that it justifies universal screening. But singling out a single group, which effectively denies screening to others for such a hot-button issue as herpes, I don't think is not a road that we have felt ready to travel down at this point. So for operational reasons, HSV screening should be implemented on a universal basis. It's just I am worried that it would be just a very gnarly situation to do it otherwise. So how can we address the gap most feasibly in the future? Well, we could think about using existing funding for testing, but that puts me back in the previous discussion. That is, we would have to cut corners from our currently existing budget, and what would we cut, and what would that cost us in terms of services, not just the dollar value, but the services foregone. And again, it would only be able to be on a targeted basis, which the resounding response has been that it is just an advisable thing to do. Another thing that we might do is to just figure out a way to obtain the funds necessary for universal STD clinic HSV screening. New funding for HSV testing is unlikely from the usual government streams. Maybe we need to think about some public-private partnerships that have not been explored in great depth before. That has worked really well for us in getting our school screening program started, and maybe this is a route that we should consider. Maybe we need to work with the city to lobby for a system so that we can at least generate some revenues from our billing and credit them to the STD clinic system. That is a plus-minus route, though. There are advantages and disadvantages. There are some jurisdictions here that do that, that have a system like that set up. And maybe later, if there's interest, we can discuss that. Or what is, you know, most available and at hand is assuming a high rate of seropositivity among our patients. If you walk in our doors, chances are very high that you are that you have genital herpes. And if we presume infection, then what we need to be doing is routinely educating our staff so that they can educate our patients about what that means, what are their risks, what symptoms to be looking for, and what strategies they could implement to prevent HSV transmission and acquisition. And continue to offer symptomatic patients treatment at the time of visit, and to offer prescription or referral for suppression. So we are at a crossroads, but before embarking on a costly journey, what we really need to know is what's the individual impact of herpes control efforts. I mean, what will happen if we don't manage to get people completely suppressed? What's the population impact for a herpes control program in general? And what is that impact on reducing the transmission of HSV and HIV? I think that the summary benefit, I'm not sure, has been fully deciphered. I wanted to acknowledge the folks who really helped me pull these data together in very short order, as well as the New York City STD clinic staff, all 200 of them. And they are very dedicated people, and it's a hell of a lot of fun to work with them. And I want to thank you all.
Thank you. I'll ask the other speakers to come up and form the panel. Could we have the lights a little bit brighter, please, if there's someone in charge of that? And we're going to segue directly into the panel. Sammy, come up here as well. I think we can both take field questions for the panelists. I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative and ask a couple of devil's advocacy questions of Sue that asks a couple of things. One of the arguments that comes up every 4 years at the CDC treatment guidelines is the notion that a guideline, on the one hand, can be frustrating when it creates an unfunded mandate for a program to do X, and there's no money attached. But the other argument is that having that mandate helps programs carve out the funds and make the argument with the people who provide those funds. And I think that happened with chlamydia screening. So I wonder what your perspective is as whether a more specific CDC recommendation that put more heat on you basically to do more HSV testing, either diagnostically or in a screening mode, would help or hurt.
I think in the long run it would probably help. And again, it has been a real learning curve in terms of working in public-private partnership. But I do think that our high school chlamydia screening program has really shown that such a thing is possible. And that screening program, in which we got some private foundation money to help us demonstrate that screening high school kids using urine and testing for chlamydia will actually find plenty of infections, and I think that was very persuasive to our city council. We, as a result of that, got $900,000 in new needs funding to do that in high schools throughout New York City. Being able to go pitch that to a private foundation with the CDC screening recommendations, the HEDIS screening recommendations, and some local calculations that we did on screening coverage and Medicaid screening coverage that was available, I think were tremendously useful in leveraging that. And from that, it took a couple of steps, but I think it would help.
Okay, before we take the questions here, I'm going to offer the individual panelists the same thing I just did. So do you have any particular challenges or questions for each other to start the discussion going before we take questions from the floor? If not, then I saw 1, 2, 3, and 4 in that order. So please, tell us who you are, please, as well.
Erica Samoff from the California STD Control Program. Thank you all. That was very interesting.
Closer to the microphone, please.
Can you hear me now? Yeah. I'm Erica Samoff from the California STD Control Program. I want to throw something out. You talked about targeting. We know that first diagnosis does not equal incidence. What about targeting screening to young people, either adolescents, the most politically touchy, or younger, like maybe younger than 25 or something like that? A response from anybody would be welcome.
I mean, that's the kind of thing I think we really need program help in deciding where's the greatest impact in terms of what we're trying to prevent. And if it's transmission of herpes and acquisition of HIV, it might make sense to get to a particular population. And it might be that we come up with similar criteria that we already have for chlamydia, that it's an age-related thing. But that's sort of a trade-off on what's the cost and where's the impact. And I think we have to look across programs, too. Does it make sense to screen all women, and I think it's great that you do, so don't misunderstand me, or should we be saying we're going to focus on women under the age of 30 if we're trying to prevent PID and infertility, and then take some of those resources and divert it to something else? And I also was thinking in terms of overlap. You're doing rapid testing on all folks for HIV, I think. You got them in a room, you're going to be doing the test, you're going to be sitting there, it's the same counseling message, why not do a rapid herpes test in a certain select group? It might be young adults. So I think that's the kind of thinking we need, but we need more answers on how much does it cost and how much is the cost savings in looking at a group.
Yes, second person to that microphone.
Hey, Catherine Hsu from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. Thank you all. I echo Erica's comment about highlighting everything that was very important today in today's plenary session. Just a question for Dr. Pelham today. Maybe a somewhat far-fetched idea, but I want to put it out there on the tables, perhaps so that you can just sort of shoot it down and get it over with and off my mind, at least. On one of your slides, there was a mention that there were not significant amounts of genital HSV-1 infection detectable. But it occurred to me to ask the question, given that there is a slightly less relative antiviral potency of HSV, for the antivirals against HSV-1 versus HSV-2, could there have been some effect from HSV-1 shedding, maybe oral shedding, playing a role in any of the negative effects that you wound up identifying?
So I'm sorry, my ears are plugged and the audio isn't very clear here, but I think you're asking about whether how much HSV-1 could have contributed to the lack of HIV difference in HIV by arm due to less effectiveness of the antivirals against HSV-1. First of all, we only, out of 2,000 swabs, we found two that were HSV-1 PCR positive. So in my opinion, from the epi data in general, there's not strong evidence that HSV-1 is an independent risk factor for HIV. And although we didn't do shedding studies orally or genitally as a subset of 039, there was very little HSV-1 detected. So I don't think that's a big factor in the HPT-039 results.
Over here.
Because of this morning's opening plenary, I'm kind of in a...
Closer to the microphone still, please. The audio is not great from those microphones. We apologize.
And it's short. I'm I'm in a reframing kind of mindset. And so, you know, to think that we've known of this relationship between HSV and HIV pretty much from the beginning, and we also know that right now people of color in particular are disproportionately impacted by HIV, it just says to me, or it continues to validate for me, that our federal government sees our lives as disposable. To not do anything about this particular epidemic, it really speaks volumes and has made me angry sitting here listening to this, because if this is the case, then why aren't we, you know, if herpes infection makes you more susceptible to HIV infection, it says to me that our government just really doesn't give a damn. More of a comment than a question.
Yeah. Well, maybe I hear your sentiments. I think that the real question was what to do. And so when we designed our HPT-039 trial, I thought it was interesting that some ethics committees said they were so convinced from the epi data that they thought it wasn't, they questioned, I should say, whether it was ethical to randomize to placebo versus acyclovir. But I think it demonstrates the importance of epi data alone, I don't think, can drive policy. Because it's, you know, Sue showed pretty high-end cost for generic acyclovir. I think you can get it for as much as low as, I should say, $60 a year. But the question is that the right place to put resources? So I think the clinical trial tells us, with the data we have now, that this isn't the intervention that's going to reduce susceptibility. But, you know, had we had a positive result, I was fully prepared to knock on Oprah's door to say, this is a female-controlled initiative that could help particularly the populations with the highest prevalence. But unfortunately, we didn't see the result we had that we wanted to see.
Sammy is our... Well, let's let Dr. Gottlieb comment. She's our local CDC herpetologist and has thought about these things.
Right, and I just wanted to add to what Connie said, that one thing that we really do need to do a better job of is raising awareness about the link between herpes and HIV, and at least letting people who know they have herpes, we should be telling them, A, they need to get an HIV test, and perhaps be tested more routinely for HIV than the general recommendation of once in their adult lifetime. And I also think we need to let them know what kind of measures they can take to reduce that risk. And so I think raising awareness is something that we really do need to do a better job about, and letting people know that this link exists.
The awareness of the prevalence of herpes is clearly necessary. You know, if people know that, okay, herpes is out there and it's out there big time, and if I'm infected with herpes, I'm more susceptible to be infected with HIV, then, you know, that kind of create some motivation for behavioral change.
Well, I would say we don't know that it would have that effect, but we do know that if they don't know they're infected, it won't have any effect. So the bell-shaped curve is only one half of a bell-shaped curve.
I'll give you one.
The other tail doesn't count. Dr. Richwald.
Well, let me make one comment. I'll give you one anecdote, because after this morning's story seemed to be a good thing. We're sitting at lunch on the CDC STD, which is primarily bacterial health disparities, with Bob Fullilove and Benny Prim. And Benny is a big activist in HIV. And we talked about the herpes data. He had no idea. He was appalled. He said, well, how come I don't know this? I said, that's a good question. He said, well, we should be talking about this. I said, you're right. So I think we haven't actually done an effective job, and I would include myself in that, in communicating this to the most affected populations to allow them to be able to make decisions about what to do.
Dr. Richwald.
Gary Richwald, former director of the LA County STD program. I thought all the presentations were terrific. I think they showed people's basic thinking about the problem, and that would be useful to everyone here. Dr. Blank, you started with a series of slides about the legal justification and funding for your program. This is a communicable disease program. Having studied the New York legal system around communicable diseases, and the reason you're funded is to prevent other people from getting these diseases. Period. Beginning and end. There is a list of diseases, and as you mentioned, herpes is part of that list. From January 1st of 2004, when Dr. Corey and a collaborative international group published the article in the New England Journal of Medicine saying that if I had HSV, if I have HSV2 and my partner here doesn't, and I take was valacyclovir, but there's reason to think that acyclovir would also do, I will reduce transmission to that partner, independent of condom use and other issues, by 48-49%. That's what that study said more than 3 years ago now. You don't need HIV, you don't need a successful or failed trial of intervention to understand what communicable disease control is here. This has been sadly neglected. There has not been a federal initiative. Peter and I were talking to somebody in one of the training programs, and I said, why not a training program to raise awareness among the clinicians? And he said, well, we don't have an initiative on herpes at the federal level at all.
Gary, I'm sorry. No, we need to come.
I'm going to ask the question.
We need to come to a question because we have limited time.
I was just wondering. Wanted to ask Dr. Blank, have you submitted a budget that reflected what it would take to theoretically improve the rates of subsequent uninfected individuals remaining uninfected in the city of New York? Because that would seem to me to be a critical element of disease control. The costs are the politicians' issues, as other people have mentioned here, but the science and the advocacy falls directly with public health. And I've been disappointed for a long time. I was unsuccessful.
I'm going to ask for Sue's response. We need to move along. Sue.
Actually, Dr. Richwell, we did submit a new needs proposal, and it was rejected. You know, I don't know the answer to that, but we could talk about it afterwards.
Not asking for a response, but I would ask whether New York has considered whether you could start looking at diagnostic testing, support for serological testing for people who need it because of symptomatic diagnosis and perhaps their partners, and then get a foot in the door. But I don't want to take too much time to get into that
right.
in any great detail.
I mean, actually, we have undertaken a variety of different efforts besides just requesting additional funding so that we could do herpes testing. I mean, we've been working with our public health lab so that we could establish PCR capability. And, you know, I think of the options that I showed, I think maybe what we need to be doing is to just simply say to people, you are at high risk. Whether we diagnose you or not, you are at extraordinarily high risk for herpes. And this is what you need to know about herpes. And whether or not somebody is in fact has herpes, genital herpes, knowing that information, you know, knowledge is power. And that begins to also address some of the issues that were raised by the gentleman who was at that microphone over there about community awareness and how could people not know about it. I think we have some low-tech tools that we could put into play that I think we have not aggressively put into play and probably should be.
Dr. Martin.
David Martin from New Orleans. Connie, this is an opportunity to ask me a question.
Closer to the mic, please.
I'm sorry, what?
Closer to the mic.
Okay. Connie, a question for you. BV is associated with HSV fairly consistently in a number of studies. and BV is also associated with HIV transmission. Is there a possibility that there is an interaction with BV in the studies that you've done? You probably thought about this, so I'd be interested in, yeah, your thoughts on this,
yeah,
issue.
Thanks, Dave. So the question about BV and herpes and the interaction that appears to, that potentially part of herpes effect is mediated by BV in terms of HIV acquisition. We have baseline BV data, it's 40% in the women here. Unfortunately, there's not a swab at the end of the study, so I can't tell you how that changed over time. What impressed me, however, when I go to Africa and talk to the women is they would often describe their symptoms as vaginal discharge. So it is possible. In our parallel study, we are going to have longitudinal BV data on both the HIV positive and negative women, so we'll have more data soon. But I think it's possible it's part of it. I think it's also recent data are suggesting that part of the effect of circumcision on reducing HIV acquisition may be mediated by HSV2. So these are, a number of these interactions are complex, but I think it's possible for BV.
Dr. Marazzo.
Jean Marazzo from Seattle. Very nice presentation. So in talking to providers a lot about herpes updates and the availability of serology and the lack of clear recommendations for implementing those, one of the most enduring areas of skepticism, I would say, on the part of providers is that knowledge of their HSV, their patient's HSV2 serostatus is really going to change behavior in a sustained way and going to result in, I think, a reduction of infection to other partners or other favorable outcomes. And I'm just wondering if you could, I mean, providers basically think, well, it's fine, I'll talk to them about it, but it's not really gonna make a difference in the long run, and because they're not gonna understand it, the subclinical shedding, or they're not gonna change behavior. I'm just wondering if you could comment on the database that really supports our ability to say that there is evidence to say that this changes behavior.
I'll just jump in and say that that's, I don't think we know, and I think if you wanted to put together a list of priorities of the translational research that needs to be done, that is extremely high on the list. We have reasons for pessimism with respect to, optimism with respect to HIV when people are told they're positive, but little effect when they're told their results are negative. Whether that translates to HSV is a fascinating question and could be studied somewhere along the line. Do any of the panelists have comments on that?
Yeah, and I think if we're going to move the field forward, it's exactly that kind of question. So what I'd like to do is say, okay, knowing what we know, how do we actually measure, can we look at, does it have an effect? The low-cost things that we can do now, and what is that effect? So we have an idea of whether it's worth the squeeze, so to speak, on it, because I honestly don't know. Now, maybe someone like Dennis might know, but I'm not aware of that. I can tell you, again, what you can say is the negative of not knowing can't be helpful. And then you get into the whole social justice thing of should we providing people that information if you're looking at increasing the risk 3 or 4-fold. And I would even frame it even further. Maybe we should be looking at short-term behaviors over the first few months after a diagnosis, much like we do acute HIV, saying, look, it's unrealistic to tell someone that the behavior we expect is for the rest of their life. What's the impact, or can we come up with measures that would say for the next 3 or 4 months, what's the benefit of increasing condom use? So you're shaping this and reducing it down to something that people feel they could do.
Sammy, do you have a comment on that?
The thing I'd say is that we really do need to have a lot more data about what works. I mean, what is going to be the overall impact of these kind of interventions? We all agree that it's important and that we need to approach this. But the question is, what do we do with it? And how do we know what's the most effective approach when we find out someone is positive for HSV2? So I think we really need to focus on that and push for getting more data that can help guide decision making.
Last question.
My name is Marianne Marlowe, and I'm from Rockford, Illinois.
Still, go like everybody else, right up at the microphone. Play Mick Jagger.
My name is Marianne Marlowe, and I'm from Rockford, Illinois. And the state of Illinois came up with some funds for us to do universal testing through blood serology on everyone that wanted it in our STD clinic. And we thought the city of Chicago was going to reach the numbers that the state wanted before we could get people tested. But we got everyone tested for like 6 or 7 months that wanted it. The problem was that no one was prepared. The patients weren't prepared for a positive test result. We weren't prepared to deliver the messages. I've been working 28 years in public health, so I know what herpes is. We've come a long way. We had no culture to begin with. Then we had cultures for wealthy people. And then, you know, things got better. We also have medication in Illinois to give people that are symptomatic, and we have suppression. I'm an advocate also for Bridges to Access, so I can get people Valtrex that want it if they qualify. So we've come a long way, and this gentleman over here, I don't know if he's still here or not, but we have come a long way in public health. You're speaking maybe from the New York side. There's a lot more people in New York than there is in Winnebago County, but in downstate Illinois. But we have come a long way, and there is an impact on behavior change when people find out they have herpes. Because now, okay, you had gonorrhea, you had chlamydia, you had things that we could treat. Now you have something that we can't cure you. And they leave thinking more about behavior change. That's where my opinion
is. Comments?
Well, first of all, this may not sound sympathetic to the people who have to do the counseling, but when we were enrolling for HPTN-039, we screened over 2,000 gay men in Seattle, and you can do counseling in 5 or 10 minutes. So personally, I feel like let's be honest about when we have 30, 45-minute interactions with people, it is feasible. It's not trivial. It's not 1 minute, but I think that counselors and clinicians can learn to really give bulleted messages. And there are a number of really good resources here. Charlie Ebel's in the audience, and he and Anna Wald wrote a wonderful book on diagnosing and counseling about herpes. So I think we need to not use that as a reason to not do it. It can be done efficiently, can be done well. People prefer, you know, there are hard questions to answer, where did I get it, and so on. But that comes up with any STI.
This is a great theme for me to ask Dr. Blank to make a closing comment, because I was going to ask, this leads into a way I was going to pose a closing question as well. You started doing, like all STD clinics, pap smears sometime in the last few years, and you've more recently had to integrate with your pap smears the fact that this is an STD, your abnormalities due to HPV, and that raises essentially pretty much a similar series of questions and dialogue of the very complex looking list of points you made about HSV. And I'm sure you found ways to make that discussion go smoothly and quickly in a lot of cases. Is there an analogy, and what do you think about Connie's comments about saying, yes, these are the goals of ideal counseling, but there are ways that we can push this through in the positives in just 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 4 minutes? What are your thoughts about that?
I think that there are, you know, it's not just counseling the HSV positive. I mean, I think that there, what this is resoundingly saying to me is just we need generic education. I mean, I think for clinical staff as well as for patients, and you know, the counseling for the person who has HSV, yeah, I mean, you can distill it to certain bullets, and there's no saying how long is the ideal counseling period. I mean, I think that different people manage information differently and receive it differently. I'm optimistic in that one way, by hook or by crook, we're going to figure out what we need, you know, what we can best do. And yeah, we have been thrown some curveballs over the decades of, you know, new diseases, new STDs, including HIV. And so I think, you know, we'll be able to distill something out of it. I think also as the general public education level about herpes, you know, gets diffused, I think the counseling becomes easier. Counseling around HIV today, you know, at this point, CDC doesn't, you don't really require much pretest counseling. 20 years ago, that would have gotten tomatoes hurled at me at high velocity. So I think that, you know, as awareness grows and as knowledge of the pathophysiology and epidemiology of herpes grows, I think the messages are just going to get easier to deliver.